Welcome to this Walnut Wednesday edition of the My Ag Life Daily News Report. I'm your host, Lori Boyer. In addition to our special Walnut Wednesday report, we'll bring you a look at national and regional agricultural news here on the show today. And I'll start things off with a look at regional agricultural news right after this.
Sponsored by the California Walnut Board and Commission, supporting the industry with on-farm innovation through production research, advocacy for government programs, and driving consumer demand. Doing more together.
Check. According to the latest National Agricultural Statistics Service's California Crop Progress and Condition Report, average low temperatures for California ranged from 31 to 59 degrees in the mountains last week, 45 to 61 along the coast, 45 to 74 in the desert, and 52 to 70 in the Central Valley. Average high temperatures for the state range from 47 to 88 in the mountains, 57 to 98 along the coast, 82 to 98 degrees in the Central Valley, and 87 to 104 in the desert. From the California Department of Water Resources, snowpack water content in the northern Sierra was 29.50 inches compared to 2.20 inches this date last year. Central Sierra was 35.30 inches compared to 1.70 inches this date last year. Southern Sierra was 33.70 inches compared to 2.30 inches this date last year. In the fruit crops, grape buds continued to open and leaf out. Some bloom clusters were present. Grapes were sprayed for weeds and mildew. Peach orchards were thinned and sprayed for weeds. Apricots and early peach varieties began to be harvested. Navel orange harvest was slowed while Valencia orange harvest continued. Lemons, grapefruit, and mandarins continued to be picked and packed. Seedless varieties of mandarins were netted to prevent pollination. Kiwi growers placed bee apiaries in groves as kiwi vines started to leaf out and bloom. Dates continued to ripen. Cherry harvest began in some orchards. Olives were treated for nematodes. Apples were sprayed for fire blight. Blueberries were irrigated and early harvest began in some areas. Strawberries continued to be picked. In the nut crops, the weather became more stable, allowing growers to catch up on fertilizing and weeding orchards. Pistachios, walnuts, and pecans continued to mature. Some pistachio growers started small plant bug treatments to protect nutlets from damage. Meat field continued in almonds. Almonds were treated for nematodes. And for vegetable crops, asparagus harvest was winding down in the Sacramento Valley. The cherry tomato crop was delayed a few weeks due to late planting caused by wet conditions. In Stanislaus County, tomatoes and sweet potatoes were transplanted into fields. In San Mateo County, Brussels sprout fields were fumigated. In Tulare County, cucumbers, zucchini, watermelon, cantaloupe, and leafy greens were planted. Sweet corn, eggplant, okra, peppers, and garlic were growing well. Onions and zucchini plants began to bloom. In response to the latest runoff conditions and flood impact modeling, Governor Gavin Newsom has signed an executive order updating and extending recent emergency actions to allow expedited floodwater diversion, debris removal, levee repairs, and other flood preparation and response activities in the Tulare Lake and San Joaquin River basins, and to allow diversion of floodwater for groundwater recharge purposes statewide. The order extends to the San Joaquin River Basin floodwater diversion waivers included in a prior executive order covering the Tulare Lake Basin. The San Joaquin River Basin may face increased flood risk as the historic snowpack in the Sierra Nevada continues to melt. The order includes refined requirements for new flood diversion and groundwater recharge efforts in the Tulare Lake and San Joaquin River Basins to protect water quality, infrastructure, and wildlife habitats. With flooding impacts expected to continue into summer, California is committed to supporting robust preparation, response, and recovery efforts in this hard-hit region and to using floodwaters to recharge our critical groundwater supplies where it is safe to do so, according to Governor Newsom. He says they'll continue working with local partners to protect lives and livelihoods on the ground while advancing investments to protect communities throughout the state from future flooding. At the request of the Kern River Water Master, the order also facilitates diversions of water into the Kern River Entry, which connects to the California Aqueduct as part of the State Water Project system. These diversions will reduce the amount of excess Kern River water that could otherwise contribute to flooding in the Tulare Lake Basin. State agencies are working with the Kern River Water Master to implement the use of the entry as soon as possible. Last week, Governor Newsom announced new proposed investments for a total of $492 million in budget funding to support the response to flood impacts throughout the state and help communities build resilience to future floods. This includes funding for multi-benefit floodplain reconnection and habitat restoration restoration projects in the San Joaquin and Tulare Basins. In addition, the state will provide funding to raise a levee in Cochran, and that is critical to maintaining public safety in the Tulare Basin region. The administration is also proposing legislation that codifies provisions from the March 10th executive order that set clear conditions for diverting floodwaters for groundwater recharge without permits or affecting water rights. With DWR projecting continued flooding impacts in the coming months, the state continues to support and conduct operations to forecast flood impacts and provide technical assistance and flood fighting materials to help protect communities and infrastructure. The wave of atmospheric rivers that swept across California this winter has created the right conditions for plant pathogens that haven't been seen for decades in the state. University of California Davis plant pathologist Florent Truelos is getting more calls from growers and farm advisors concerned about potential crop damage. Generally, whenever you have rain events, you're going to have problems, according to Truelos. In wet years, they get really busy because most pathogens need and like water. On a recent visit to an almond orchard near Fresno, it was discovered that a thick jelly-looking substance indicating a pathogen had taken hold on some of the trees. Lab testing did confirm that it was Phytophthora, a pathogen that can affect almond crops but is rarely seen in California. If it is found, generally the site of infection are wounds caused by pruning, but that is not the case here, where the infection began in a canopy at twigs or small branches. It is a threat to a key crop, which, according to the California Department of Food and Agriculture, generates $5 billion annually. The pathogen is soil-borne, mostly found in tree roots, and doesn't generally spread up into the branches, but the intense storms created the right conditions for the pathogens to swim up the trunks as winds blew spores into the air and rain dropped them back down into the canopy. Some of the trees in the orchard will die. Others can be saved by pruning infected branches and applying a recommended fungicide. The California Avocado Commission invites avocado lovers to celebrate California Avocado Month this June. Grown in a golden state from San Diego to Monterey by about 3,000 growers, California avocado season generally runs from spring through summer, making June a perfect time to explore every delicious opportunity to sink your teeth into an avocado. Widely known as winner of the Bravo's Top Chef, the first winner of the Food Network's Tournament of Champions, and most recently as one of three titans on the Food Network's new cutthroat competition, Bobby's Triple Threat, Chef Brooke Williamson will join the California Avocado Commission in celebrating California Avocado Month by developing two fresh and unique California avocado-inspired dishes for summer. Born and raised in Los Angeles and a keeper of a fruitful home garden herself, Chef Williamson has an appreciation for in-season produce, which helps to shape and inspire her menu both at work and at home. Some of her California-inspired cuisine recipes include her braised short rib on California avocado tahini puree, which pairs melt-in-your-mouth short ribs with tangy, velvety California avocado tahini puree. And for those with a sweet tooth, Chef Williamson's California avocado chocolate mousse layer cake features cool and creamy California avocado mousse sandwiched between layers of decadent chocolate cake for the perfect make-ahead dessert. The recipes are available at businesswire.com. California avocados are not only a key ingredient in Chef Williamson's featured recipes, but they are also a heart-healthy superfood that provides naturally good fats and are sodium, cholesterol, and trans fat free. One third of a medium avocado has 80 calories and contributes nearly 20 vitamins, minerals, and phytonutrients, making it a nutrient-dense choice, according to the commission. As California's stone fruit season begins, growers and shippers know the pressure will be on the state to supply the fruit. Demand is pretty strong, especially with everything being late. Retailers are trying to fill their shelves with product, according to Marcelo Jimenez Castro, director of sales for Prima Wawona. He says what's also influencing California this year is that the southern states like Georgia had major crop failures due to weather, so they'll be covering a lot of businesses with California product. He says they expect a season with pretty good demand throughout. That said, the California stone fruit season is also starting late this year by about 3 weeks compared to historical starts due to a combination of cold and rain. Prima Wawona began its harvest of yellow peaches and yellow nectarines recently, and it's beginning with its white flesh peaches and white flesh nectarines. Harvest of apricots and plums will also begin soon. In all, the season should run until mid-October. A lot of the industry finishes by the end of August or the second week of September. They have an extended season with a late peach variety called Prima Gatti, and that will harvest until the second week in October. The crop size is similar to last year, especially for nectarines and plums. Overall, the early part of the season will be tight because some of the trees had a light set. However, mid-June to the later part of June should be more into a normal crop, he says. This year, he also adds that the fruit has many strong quality factors to it. They have an excellent eating quality on the fruit. With this weather, they got extra chill hours in the right part of the year, contributing to good flavor. Sizing is going to be good. On the early fruit, they're getting almost one size larger than what they would be getting last year. So it's a good year for size, taste, and flavor profile. As for pricing, it's looking to be stronger than last year, already a record year in pricing due to the demand pressure. He says the scarcity of other products is creating the opportunity for strong pricing that they believe will maintain throughout the season. The season will start out pretty strong in the early part and then will stabilize a bit. Even with that stabilization on the price, they hope to receive a premium on what they received last year with the added demand and the need to cover more business, according to Jimenez Castro.
AgroPlante is the leading manufacturer in specialty products. AgroPlante formulates products that rise to the challenge of today's growing conditions. Saline and sodic soils reduce crop yield and cause significant crop losses. AgroPlante developed Cation EX5 Plus with growers in mind to manage soil salinity. With multiple years of research, Cation EX5 Plus has proven to be an excellent source of calcium and an effective soil salinity manager. Run it through drip irrigation without any issues. Simplify your application method with innovative and efficient formulations. Alleviate salinity stress with Cation EX5 Plus. AgroPlante, imagination, innovation, science in action.
Whole orchard recycling has started to go mainstream as many almond growers across thousands of acres are adopting the practice in lieu of burn regulations and as a means to increase soil organic matter. The practice has been slower to catch on in walnuts, but is starting to pick up steam in certain areas of the San Joaquin Valley, especially as UCCE research updates for whole orchard recycling in walnuts are brought to light. On a recent episode of the Growing the Valley podcast, hosted by UCCE Orchard System advisors Dr. Phoebe Gordon and Luke Milliron, Milliron shared his experiences working in walnut orchards that have employed whole orchard recycling.
I'm looking at whole orchard recycling at two sites, and we're proposing to start a third site this year in 2023. But War One, the very first site, which I also call Chipocalypse because it did not go to plan, was planted back in 2019 with the incorporation of chips in 2018. And it was, you know, meant to be a nice trial with 5 acres that received chips and 5 acres that didn't. But all of these terrible things happened, and we did not get a good sense of exactly how many tons per acre of chips were deposited. And then the chips were not evenly placed in those 5 blocks. So again, a chipocalypse. We're still monitoring that trial to see, you know, are the trees stunted at all? Are there any diseases that crop up as an issue in those areas that receive chips? But it's a site we have to take with a grain of salt. And then, but I kept presenting about this site at the Walnut Research Conference that we have internally. And Cliff Bumel, who's on one of the research boards with the California Walnut Commission, came up to me and said, Luke, we need to give you a robust, you know, randomized replicated site so that we can really answer these questions. And that was planted in 2021 in the southern Sacramento Valley. And now we're looking at a third site just down the street from that in the southern Sac Valley. This War II site in Sutter County that was planted in 2021, that's on very sandy ground, as is War I. So now we're looking for this War III site also in Sutter County to be on heavy, heavy ground because that's much more representative of the Sacramento Valley. And then our colleague Mo Nouri, farm advisor in San Joaquin County, has been working with Brent Holtz on this question for a couple years as well. And he's going to have a really nice, robust trial planted this year in the northern San Joaquin Valley.
Milliron confirmed that similar to research done on whole orchard recycling in almonds, the walnut sites are examining both soil property effects and disease effects both common concerns for growers when thinking about investing money into the practice.
What we've been looking at in terms of soil has been nematodes, working with the lab of Amanda Hodson at UC Davis. We've been looking at, you know, soil chemistry, and we've also been looking at, you know, trunk circumference, as well as July leaf analysis. And then, you know, we're going to be looking more at PAR, our photosynthetically active radiation, how much shade these different trees in each treatment are taking up, and of course, yield in subsequent years. In terms of the trunk size, which is always the kind of the first result you start looking at when you have a young orchard trial, you know, before those years where you can start capturing yield, it's kind of our first early sign of what might be a successful treatment, whether it's a rootstock study or a whole orchard recycling, whatever it is. And at WAR2, we're actually looking both at, you know, whole orchard recycling, and we're also looking at different clonal rootstock treatments. So as part of that study, looking at the size of the trunks, so far there's no statistical difference between the chipped areas and the non-chipped areas. Whereas 1 year in, all of the numbers were very much kind of all on top of each other. There really truly didn't seem to be any statistical difference. Now for each one of the rootstocks, whether it's Grizzly or RX1, Vlach, VX211, although there's still no statistical difference here at, you know, after the 2022 growing season, in for each one of those rootstocks, the trees that are in the chipped areas are at least numerically larger. And then, you know, moving on to survival, which is of course the other very early thing that we're looking at, and always concerned that with whole orchard recycling, you know, maybe there will be an increase in disease, that because we're not removing and burning up the previous orchard, you know, is any of that disease going to stick around? But so far, very good survival rates across all treatments. And so far in the control treatments, there have been, you know, 5 trees that have needed to be replanted in the small trial. And in the areas where there was whole orchard recycling, there have also been 5 trees. So far, no difference there, which is good to see. Moving on to nematodes, and the most important nematode when it comes to walnut production is root lesion. So there was no difference before the trees were planted. And then, you know, a year later after the first growing season, this was in November 2021, there was a stunning difference. So the number of root lesion per 250 grams of soil in the whole orchard recycling areas was only 22, while it was 691 in the control areas. So a massive difference there, but only 1 year. So we're looking forward to getting in those 2022 results from Amanda Hodson and seeing whether there's still an advantage for the whole orchard recycling trees for a second year, or whether that was just a 1 year blip.
Dr. Gordon was curious if Mill Iron's upcoming trial at the third walnut whole orchard recycling site would look at nitrogen fertilization rates in the future, as UCCE advisor Brent Holtz, who pioneered the practice, hypothesized that early nitrogen applications in these orchards would require double the normal amount. And while this was later proven to not be the case, Mill Iron confirmed he'll still be looking into nitrogen fertilization at the third site, as well as other practices.
We're hoping to look at that at this WAR3 site that we're hoping to start developing this year. And I know Mo Nori will be looking at that at his North San Joaquin Valley site as well. He's going to have a trial looking at that. And some other things we're hoping to be looking at is cover cropping and having that as a overlaying feature. And then also looking at fumigation, no fumigation. The WAR1 Chipocalypse site, the entire field was fumigated, versus at WAR2, we absolutely gave the trees the most extreme bad possible scenario. So the trees were removed after harvest in November, and there was no fumigation done. And then you had trees being planted the, you know, just that next March, just a few months later. So that's the real extreme situation. So definitely wanting to look at nitrogen rates, presence and absence of cover crops, and then this question of fumigation, because we're certainly concerned that in addition to potentially having to do whole orchard recycling in the coming decades with air quality regulations, we're already seeing that across the San Joaquin Valley, and we expect that will come to the Sacramento Valley. We're also expecting really tightening regulations with the use of fumigants, which we're hearing about with these new kind of crackdowns on telone use. So that's something we need to be looking at as well.
For more on this topic, check out Mill Iron and Dr. Gordon at the Growing the Valley podcast at growingthevalleypodcast.com. For My Ag Life, I'm Taylor Tallstrom.
Sponsored by the California Walnut Board and Commission, supporting the industry with on-farm innovation through production research, advocacy for government programs, and driving consumer demand. Doing more together.
Biofuels like ethanol must not be ignored as a climate solution. That was part of the testimony by Kansas Corn Growers Association Josh Rowe in front of a House Oversight Subcommittee hearing recently. The discussion centered on vehicle emissions rules and the electric vehicle transition. Unfortunately, current and proposed EPA rules prevent them from being a part of the solution, according to Rowe. While they believe electric vehicles will play a vital role in achieving climate goals, other complementary alternatives like biofuels have a key role to play but are being pushed aside. Rowe also questioned the EPA proposal that considers electric vehicles as zero emission. He says they aren't truly zero emission vehicles. While they don't have a tailpipe, you still have to account for the emissions that come from the power grid. The U.S. power grid is 60% powered by coal and natural gas, and EPA rules do not account for upstream emissions. The USDA has announced grant funding for local projects to boost participation in USDA's Special Supplemental Nutrition Program for women, infants, and children. USDA Ag News reporter Gary Crawford.
The USDA's WIC program provides low-income women, infants, and children with supplemental healthy foods and also health information and medical referrals and such. The problem is this.
Only 50% of all eligible individuals participate in WIC, a shortfall of almost 6 million moms, babies, and young children missing out on critical benefits.
USDA Food and Nutrition Services Deputy Undersecretary Stacy Dean telling reporters Thursday that to close that gap, the USDA, along with the Food Research and Action Center, is allocating $16 million in grants for 36 local community projects in order to
test new ways for reaching eligible families,
including
co-locating WIC staff at medical offices, developing culturally appropriate materials, and so many more, including reaching out to military families.
Dean said the USDA is also working nationally to make WIC more accessible
so that more eligible moms, babies, and young children can tap into the program's incredible benefits.
Gary Crawford reporting for the U.S. Department of Agriculture.
A bitterly partisan House subcommittee markup for the fiscal year 2024 USDA Food and Drug Administration spending bill brought into sharp focus the contrast between GOP and Democratic policies. The GOP bill cuts USDA FDA discretionary spending by $532 million to just over $25 billion, but relies heavily on $8 billion in unused Biden pandemic funds to achieve that. Ag Appropriations Subcommittee Chair Andy Harris.
This legislation rejects the Biden administration's unrealistic proposed spending levels that are detached from the dire fiscal reality our country faces.
The GOP would expand SNAP work requirements, cut the Women, Infants, and Children program, rescind racial equity and rural clean energy programs, limit the Commodity Credit Corporation discretionary authority, and reduce rural electric co-op and Farm Service Agency loan forgiveness, along with the Natural Resources Conservation Service and Agriculture Marketing Service spending. The GOP directly attacks Vilsack's Commodity Credit Corporation spending authority for using it for his Climate Smart Ag program. But Chair Harris adds,
restricting these authorities and returning them to pre-COVID language will have no impact on Farm Bill and conservation programs, crop insurance, or the Secretary's ability to access the CCC in the case of an animal or health emergency.
The bill, advancing on a party line vote, will also go after farmland ownership by China and other foreign adversaries.
Don't miss your opportunity to attend the only event of its kind taking place this summer. Join us on June 21st, 2023 in Modesto, California for the Crop Consultant Connect event. The Crop Consultant Connect event will bring you and many of your independent crop consultant peers together. You'll also get access to virtual CE hours as an exclusive thank you for attending this event. Your registration includes breakfast, lunch, coffee, snacks, as well as a wealth of information you're able to glean from this experience. Please visit progressivecrop.com for more information. Join us on June 21st in Modesto, California for the Crop Consultant Connect event.
JCS Marketing is your number one way to connect with the ag industry. Through print magazines, digital media, podcasts, and live and virtual events, JCS Marketing has the reach to inform, educate, and influence growers in the Western United States.
Everywhere you go, you see West Coast Nut Magazine on every one of my customers' tables. So that tells you everything. It's there, so they're reading it.
Our My Ag Life platform includes podcast interviews and digital articles for busy professionals on the go. Our live events, continuing education webinars, and virtual conferences help growers connect with leading researchers and industry leaders. Let JCS Marketing help you connect.
That will wrap up today's show. You've been listening to the My Ag Life Daily News Report. I'm Lori Boyer. From all of us here at the JCS Marketing team, thank you for listening.